Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, September 1st, 2026. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Controversial program takes public school students off campus in several schools in Washington and in Grangeville, Idaho for religious indoctrination. Activist talks about the impact of Christian nationalism on Idaho politics. And University of Idaho library archivists examine optical character recognition through the lens of archival ethics, especially surrounding artificial intelligence enhancement of optical character recognition of historical documents. That's all coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The LifeWise Academy program, which takes children out of public schools during school hours for religious indoctrination, is gaining traction in the Northwest and is currently operating in 14 school districts in Washington and at least one in Idaho. Promoters say the Bible-based program is open to all children regardless of religious affiliation and is allowed under a 1952 U.S. Supreme Court ruling, which permits school districts to allow students to leave school grounds for a few hours for religious instruction. The decision said the instruction must take place off school property, be privately funded, and require parental permission in order for the children to participate. Critics of the LifeWise Academy program, which is growing nationwide, say the program encourages enrollees to recruit other children. The NBC television network has reported LifeWise promises incentives to children, such as ice cream or popcorn parties, if students meet a recruitment quota. LifeWise State Director for Washington, Elise Morrissey, told the Faith and Values News they have teams actively working to establish the program in 26 school districts across the state and claims parents from 83% of the state's 295 school districts have expressed interest in the program. Morrissey also claims truancy drops precipitously in districts that have the program. The Guardian reports LifeWise's curriculum tries to avoid political topics such as gender and sexuality, but if students ask questions, they recommend instructors tell the children divorce, LGBTQ identities, and cohabitation without marriage are sinful, even though those things are not sinful. LifeWise Academy program recently started in the Grangeville Mountain View School District in north central Idaho, where 26 students marched 3 minutes from the Grangeville Elementary Middle School to the Grangeville Christian Church for several hours of religious indoctrination each week. The program started in Grangeville with 5 students at the beginning of the 2025-2026 school year and was up to 26 students by summer break. There are no reported lawsuits against school districts for violating the separation of church and state, but LifeWise Academy recently prevailed in a lawsuit they filed against Everett Public Schools in Washington. In April, a U.S. district judge issued a preliminary injunction requiring the Everett School District allow LifeWise to participate in community resource fairs, display printed flyers in schools wherever flyers from secular organizations are allowed, and teach students who have parental permission.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored in part by Stop Northwest Gas Expansion, an alliance committed to exposing the truth about the harms to our health and safety caused by toxic and explosive natural gas, and preventing these harms by stopping the expansion of gas supply, including increases in gas pipeline pressure.
KRFP is also sponsored by Rembrandt Tree Care, family owned and operated since 1977. A conscientious approach to urban forestry with year-round tree service on the Palouse and surrounding areas. You can reach Rembrandt Tree Care at 509-330-0699.
At the Alturas Institute's Exceptional Women Conference in Sun Valley last week, KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox spoke to activist Gwen McEnany about the impact of Christian nationalism on Idaho politics, including the impact laws sponsored by Republican State Senator Brian Lenny of Nampa have had on the rights of Idaho women.
I'm a lifelong resident of Idaho. I grew up understanding about the importance of the career of Senator Frank Church. So in 1984, when I was invited by members of the Boise Peace Quilt Project to help make a quilt for him as he lay dying of pancreatic cancer, I was eager to participate. We made the quilt in 7 weeks. It went back to his home in D.C., and his widow, Bethine, told me later that when the quilt arrived and it had squares that had been made by family and friends, it changed the whole atmosphere in the room. Because before, people didn't know what to say. Everyone was so saddened by this tragic loss. But in fact, they started talking about, oh, I remember when we were up in the Sawtooth camping. Oh, that was my favorite dog. He always chased every ball we ever threw. So the idea of looking at global peacemaking through a local lens, of finding ways for people to respect the dignity of everyone. Senator Frank Church, his entire career, and there's a new film called The American Patriot that we've just viewed in Boise through OSHA, the Lifelong Learning Institute there. And it reminded me of the importance of standing up and speaking out. And of course, I've been trying to do that for my entire life. I'm now 75. I'm still an active member of the Boise Peace Quilt Project. We just gave our latest quilt to the Artisans for Hope, the group that has helped refugees who've come to our valley learn marketable skills, English, gather in community. All the things that I've done through my life advocating for children and youth as a speech-language pathologist have reminded me that we do not need a theocracy. We do not need one religion imposing its views on a pluralistic society. We need to find ways for everyone, again, to live in the Idaho that I grew up in, where people were definitely in different parties, but they worked across the aisle in the best interests of everyday Idahoans. So I'm very upset that people have moved, particularly from the outside, like Senator Brian Lenny in the West Valley, and he is imposing religious principles through legislation on all Idahoans. And especially his focus has been diverting public tax dollars into private education, as well as he is behind so many of the draconian measures with regard to the rights of LGBTQ people and trans. He's the sponsor of the bathroom bill, for example. And in fact, everything that I've, my contact with him personally, because I go down to the Capitol, I submit testimony in writing, I'm generally there. If I'm called for a witness, I'm happy to speak up because I draw on the strength of other people currently working with children and youth in education and in healthcare. But they are telling me, and I can observe with my own eyes, that if you have white Christian nationalism attempting to take over our democracy, there are going to be people with rights and people without rights. And in particular, women are going to be really disadvantaged. And we see this if there's an attempt to make it impossible for women to regulate their fertility through using birth control. They may find that they are unable to plan their future. They can't, for example, want to go to college and get married at the same time. Right now, we know that many women are balancing educational goals with being a wife and a mother because they can determine when they can welcome a child into their home. The same thing for educators. I work for the Boise School District, and typically young women would plan their pregnancies for the spring, end of the school year, so they could be home for 3 months with this little infant before coming back to work. Well, if you were going to get pregnant at any old time and you had to stop out of the workforce as a result of that, your whole family was at risk financially because, as one educator told me, gee, Gwen, I'd love to stay home, but, you know, my husband teaches too. He's at another school. And on our salaries, we can't afford to raise children unless both of us continue to work. So she and he were teaching children whose families were wealthier, and one person could step out of the workforce. Well, the good news is we should give everyone the opportunity to balance being a professional or working in any area of interest and being parents. And one of the big problems I have right now is all of the cuts to family support measures in our state and nationally. Because if we want to thrive, both as a state and as a country, we have to nurture the next generation. And if we're taking away the financial resources that mean that parents can keep a roof over the children's head and clothes on their back and food on the table, we're just doing all of us in. I mean, and so the goals of white Christian nationalism, as I understand them, and I've attended conferences and I've been reading a great deal, appear to be they want the male hierarchy of particularly white men, and they don't want to have anyone else share leadership, be able to speak on behalf of any minority group. I mean, even women are a majority minority group, but to try to silence women, try to go back to really the dark ages where women were just basically walking wombs. The only thing they were good for was reproduction. And it really galls me. But you know, when I was growing up, it was like, oh, a joke. Women need to be barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. And I've heard that the people up north in these really conservative white supremacist circles are saying, no, 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 we'll let them wear Birkenstocks. But they still need to be in the kitchen baking sourdough. So they don't have to be barefoot anymore, but they don't need to vote because he will be head of household. They don't need to speak in any forum. They're supposed to be meek and submissive. And if anything goes wrong in their marriage, it's the woman's fault. And he has the right to discipline her. So domestic violence, all kinds of sexual assault within the marriage is not, can see that, because she cannot have agency. She can't say, we need to talk about this, what we're going to do together. We need to come to a situation because we have equal partnership in this marriage and responsibilities within the family. And instead of just saying gender is destiny, biology is destiny, we need to recognize the fact that men and women have strengths that we might consider feminine or masculine. And instead of being so rigid and thinking in black and white terms and concrete, we need to welcome the whole human family, the whole breadth and spectrum, from young to old and everybody in between, and we need to support them. We don't need to dictate, and we don't need to. I've often said, hey, if there's a situation here, everybody get into the lifeboat. Everybody grab an oar. Everyone together, doesn't matter, color, race, religion, we're all row for the same shore. No more talk about throwing someone overboard. Oh, you don't belong, or we're not going to save you, or you're too heavy, you're out of here. No, everybody is united. And so the panels that we've been listening to here at the conference reinforce this notion that we're one world. I wrote a poem in 1968 as a senior at Bishop Kelly High School in Boise, and I can still remember the opening line, "Oh, the world seen from afar." And it was about the first images of the world, that beautiful blue dot in space that were being sent back by our astronauts. And very much like Ellen Ochoa, our astronaut speaker, said, my poem went on to talk about, at 68,000 miles, you don't see war and the ravages of war. You don't see the disease, the illness, you know. Why is it we're here on Earth and we can, and we're letting it happen? So it was a call to arms. And at my 50th high school reunion a few years ago, one of my classmates came up and said, Gwen, I just wanted to tell you how much that poem meant to me back in the day. And all these years have gone by, and I can finally tell you, I found that so inspiring. And she's been very active in nonprofit work, as a matter of fact. So I think there are a lot of ways we can help one another by moving away from the extremism that is not Christian, that is not based in Jesus' gospel, that in fact is very antithetical to everything that Jesus wanted. He welcomed everyone to the table. We need to do that.
That was Gwyn McEnany of Nampa speaking to KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox at the Alturas Institute's Exceptional Women Conference in Sun Valley last week.
Conservationists in Oregon are looking beyond their own species and to the state's iconic beaver to learn how to be more resilient to wildfires. By slowing down and spreading out waterways, research shows beaver dams significantly reduce wildfire burn severity. Maureen Thompson is with Central Oregon nonprofit Think Wild. She says when it comes to wildfire prevention, beaver ponds are a big help.
That means we have late season water for wildlife and for fire breaks. Firefighters in the Ochocos know where the big beaver ponds are and literally send the helicopters there to get big buckets of water to put out the fires.
Thompson adds intense fires delayed beaver restoration work this summer, so Think Wild is now calling for fall volunteers to help build starter dams and survey beaver activity across central and eastern Oregon. She says dozens of volunteer days are planned and people can sign up at beaverworksoregon.org. Thompson says scientists know beaver populations are generally growing in the state, but research about how to use public lands to support them is lacking, making volunteer data collection essential. She adds that taking an active role in wildlife conservation is not just helpful for the beavers.
People can see that they are changing the world for the better, and that sense of agency and hope is so important, especially now. And it's also just really fun.
Oregon's beaver bill came into effect in 2024, which encourages coexistence with the tail-slapping rodents. The law mandates landowners must first try non-lethal deterrents to be rid of them and must get a permit before killing them. Thompson says the bill is exciting because it also codifies the important role the animals play in creating cleaner water, as well as habitat for other wildlife. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Republican U.S. Representative Russ Fulcher of Idaho's 1st Congressional District says he is co-sponsoring H.R. 9716, which would limit federal law enforcement's access to data from automated license plate reader cameras, such as Flock or Axon cameras. The legislation would require a judicial warrant for the federal government to access state or local license plate reader camera data, Fulcher wrote in a press release. I'm proud to sign on to this legislation to protect the privacy rights of Idahoans from increasingly intrusive surveillance data collection and to prohibit the widespread deployment of such surveillance tools with federal dollars. The Idaho Capital Sun reports H.R. 9716 would also put time limits on how long federal authorities can hold on to data they have obtained from local law enforcement via Flock cameras unless a court authorizes an extension or the data is needed for an ongoing prosecution. The bill would also prohibit federal funds from being used to purchase or install surveillance devices, with some exceptions for systems used solely for toll collections on federally funded highways, school violence prevention programs, grants provided under the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act, and portable systems for specific law enforcement operations with a warrant. Republican U.S. Representative Keith Self of Texas introduced the bill July 15th, but it has not yet come before a committee for a vote. Idaho legislators passed a law last year that bans the use of license plate reader cameras for anything other than the investigation of felony, misdemeanor crimes, traffic accidents, or to search for missing or endangered persons. The speakers at the University of Idaho Malcolm Renfrew Interdisciplinary Colloquium today were two library archivists who examined optical character recognition, or OCR, through the lens of archival ethics, especially when it comes to using artificial intelligence to assist optical character recognition. Rebecca Hastings is a University of Idaho library employee who works in special collections and archives located in the UI library basement.
We are responsible for collecting, preserving, and maintaining unique historical records. And, you know, this in our case, we are primarily collecting records associated with the University of Idaho. And so that can include the correspondence of past university presidents, committee meeting minutes, faculty papers, things like that. We also collect on topics that are kind of more relevant to this region more broadly. So we collect on topics like forestry and mining. We hold the records of the Bunker Hill Mining Company. We hold some records that are kind of related to the Palouse, North Idaho regions. And so we hold some, I would say, pretty significant collections of photographs, audiovisual materials, things like that. But the overwhelming majority of the items in our collections are text documents or, you know, text on paper. And for this is true for most archives, I would say. And so for a long time, I would say well over a century, people have been in various fields, including archivists sometimes, have been trying to make text on paper more accessible so that, you know, you can use text beyond just like looking at something that is on a page in your hand. And so inventors have been trying to come up with machines that can recognize text on a page, handwritten sometimes, that primarily typewritten, both are good, and then transform them into some kind of output. I would say these days that output is usually digital text of some kind, but it can also be audio. In the past, it's sometimes been punch cards, kind of whatever format is helpful to us.
Hastings says as artificial intelligence has improved, so has its ability to assist optical character recognition. But that has led to new ethical challenges, particularly for archivists who are interested in digitizing history. The other UI librarian at the Renfrew presentation today was Andrew Weymouth, who gave examples of how optical character recognition often makes mistakes, especially when teamed up with AI.
When I work on these projects, I use a programming language called Python. And in addition to my normal practice of importing libraries, implementing configurations, and setting up a structure to handle the processing and output of materials, testing open large language models also involved writing a prompt into the script, exactly as one might through a chatbot. For these examples of hallucinations, my prompt was, on the right-hand corner there, transcribe only the text visible in this page, exactly as written. Output the raw text and nothing else, no quotes, no commentary, no formatting. If there's no legible text, output nothing. And so beginning with this foundational document I was using from one Abraham Lincoln, also known as Arnold Vinnick. We have the OCR output that's in blue on the right here. And then a long string of BW, BW, BW. It could be a complete fabrication. It also could be an interpretation of an extremely slight crease in the paper. And in this cursive passage, whose last two lines on the left are in the school fund from which said monies are sought to be drawn, the LLM interprets in to, as soon as the trick shall be in, him to see me any port in the sea. And this is of interest not just as a misidentification of some words, but because we can possibly see the model partially attempt to invoke the idiom, any port in a storm, perhaps only through the context clues of the style of cursive, the level of distortion on the paper, to make human-sounding patterns of speech as opposed to a one-to-one reflection of writing on a word-by-word basis.
That was UI library archivist Andrew Weymouth. Rebecca Hastings said different AI tools for optical character recognition have different levels of reliability.
LLM tools, as Andrew showed, they have inserted fabricated text. They hallucinated. This is not great for archival work. OptiColumn, it produced a lot of accurate text. It, you know, messed up occasionally, but those errors were much more recognizable and transparent, which is important. Related to transparency and accountability, OptiColumn, we understand how it was created. It, you know, it's all documented. We understand the recognition methods. We know that we can kind of reproduce the same results consistently. LLM tools are typically more of a black box, so that's kind of worth considering for archival work. On access and equity, both tools can provide, a large amount of like keyword searchable documentation. They can, they can get through a lot of archival materials, relatively efficiently. I would say that for access, especially, this idea that you might get a whole bunch of fabricated content with LLM tools. That is a real problem because for some people, their only access to these documents is going to be through the OCR text. And if you have OCR text that has a whole bunch of plausible fabrications, then someone who literally cannot see the document, they're not going to be able to pick up on the fact that those don't represent the original document properly. If we're thinking about sustainable archival workflows, LLM OCR tools, these kind of commercial tools that are widely available, those are often, you can get going on those really quickly. You don't need a lot of expertise just to get started. We don't know how to document them properly. We don't exactly know how we got the results that we got. OptiColumn probably requires more expertise to get going. But it is creating less of a dependency on an outsider that we don't know. So there is always going to be some risk or dependency no matter what tool you use. But with something like OptiColumn, it's more of an internal risk that we can manage rather than something that lives completely outside of our control. So just final thoughts. We know that no OCR tool fits every kind of situation. There are advantages and disadvantages either way, but something like OptiColumn, it fits better with archival ethics. And I think just one kind of takeaway that I had was that, the bigger lesson here is not necessarily about AI and OCR, but just kind of that having a solid ethical framework for your profession really helps to guide through these technology choices and other kind of world context issues that are happening. Things change around us a lot, but having a really good framework to fall back on.
That was UI archivist Rebecca Hastings speaking at the University of Idaho Malcolm Renfrew Interdisciplinary Colloquium today at the UI Library. KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox assisted with this story. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, there's a 20% chance of showers tonight before midnight, then a slight chance of thunderstorms after 5 a.m. Increasing clouds, low 46. 90% chance of showers and possibly a thunderstorm tomorrow, high 66. Up to a quarter inch of rain possible, except higher amounts possible in thunderstorms. Wednesday night, 90% chance of showers, low 43, up to a quarter inch of rain possible. And on Thursday, 80% chance of showers, mainly before noon, up to a quarter inch of rain possible. Current temperature is 72 degrees. Real-time air monitoring shows the air quality in Moscow. And Lewiston is moderate. It's moderate to good through the rest of north central Idaho, except Orofino, which is unhealthy for sensitive groups at this hour. Real-time air monitoring in Washington shows the air quality is good in Pullman at this hour and is moderate in Clarkston and Spokane. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business or nonprofit supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartas. Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman Community Radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online. Coming up next, Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine, followed by the live program Rude Awakening, which is on at 7:30 tonight, and which will have interesting discussions. So stay tuned for more. KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Friends of the Clearwater, a 501c3 environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting your public lands. FOC is defending the wildlands, wildlife, and waterways of north central Idaho for future generations. Friendsoftheclearwater.org.
KRFP, Moscow is the best in the USA.
Yeah.